Well, this is amazing. This is going to be an amazing interview. Maurice Cotterell will join us shortly. In 1989, engineer and scientist Maurice Cotterell found a way of calculating the duration of long-term magnetic reversals on the sun. Using this knowledge, he was able to break the codes of ancient sun-worshipping civilizations. Go ahead, try that 10 times. Try it one time. First, the Mayans of Central America, those of Tutankhamun of Egypt, and the Viracochas of South America, before cracking the codes of the Terracotta Warriors of China. And we are going to discuss with him how the 12-year Chinese astrological calendar is simply a metaphor to describe the effects of the 11.5-year sunspot cycle on human personality and behavior. So that's it. He joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. John B. Wells in with you tonight. And, you know, the last time I was in Ireland, I had just a little bit too good of a time. By the time it was all over with, I had to be rescued by a gang of leprechauns and floated out of the country on a raft made of empty whiskey bottles. It was a great trip. But coming to us live from the Emerald Isle is Maurice Cotterell. And this is a beautiful book that you have written, The Future Science Forbidden, or Future Science, Forbidden Science of the 21st Century. It would take 12 hours to go through this minimum, but it's just an extraordinary work. And welcome to the program. We cannot wait to hear what you have to say tonight.
Thank you, John.
So, where shall we begin? Before you explain to us how astrology works, tell us this. You figured out how astrology works around 25 years ago and have since then included the mechanism in many of your books, best-selling books that are available in more than 20 languages worldwide. So why has the mainstream media refused to share your discoveries with the public, and why do they continually pretend that astrology cannot work and cannot be explained scientifically? That word again.
Well, as most of the Coast to Coast listeners appreciate, John, the mainstream media is run by the establishment, and the establishment is run by the Freemasons. And they know that if they tell you how astrology works, you'll be able to figure out everything else, like what God is, what hell is, how to get to heaven, even how gravity works.
How gravity works.
Exactly. And all of this is explained in Future Science.
Well, as I say, this is an extraordinary work. It really is. It's I wish this was televised. That day may come. Maybe not. Many of us have the face for radio, so no television for us. But what's wrong with that? Why shouldn't we all know about it? Isn't there more for them to gain by general enlightenment among the populace and to just keep it restricted to the chosen few?
Well, yes and no, John. The problem is, if you start explaining how to get to heaven to people, that's fine. The problem is, once you figure out how to get to heaven, it's easy to figure out how to send other people's souls to hell. And that's why the knowledge is kept secret by the Freemasons, because in the wrong hands it can be dangerous. What kind of world would we be living in if everybody started sending the soul of their adversaries to hell? That's not why we're born. We're born to purify our own soul, to get our own soul back to God, where it came from originally. And that's why this knowledge has to be kept secret. Clearly, if you fly through the astrological window, as I've already said, you can figure out all of this stuff before. And I've been fortunate in that I was the first person in our current era who has flown through that astrological window, figured out how astrology works, figured out how the sun affects us. And because of that, it's like pulling on a thread on a sweater, a loose thread. You pull on that small thread and the whole picture unravels. And it's just, once you get into this kind of knowledge, it's beautiful. But I do have some sympathy for the Freemason cause, if you like, because it's not for everybody, this knowledge. As I say, in the wrong hands, a little knowledge can be a dangerous thing. And therefore, It's not for everybody. It's for Coast to Coast listeners who are different, who are special, who ask questions, who want to know the answers to why we live, why we die, and why this has to be. And so it's not for everybody. The Bible says it's for the 144,000. It's for the few. So that's what we'll be talking about this evening.
Now, you were last on the program July 17 last year with George Knapp.
Right.
And so for those of us who may have missed you, tell us about you. What led you into this work, which is clearly your life's work?
Well, it started many years ago, as I'm sure you appreciate. When I was 20, I graduated from Naval College in the UK to work on board ship as a radio officer. And one of the things I noticed on board ship was that whenever the ship was sailing from north to south, the atmosphere on board was quite relaxed. But whenever the ship sailed from east to west, the crew became anxious and agitated. I knew that when we move from east to west, we do experience jet lag. And that's caused by a change in the production of the timing hormone melatonin, which is caused by changes in the Earth's magnetic field on our brain. At the same time, I was experiencing difficulty in contacting the UK on shortwave because it just happened to be the time of a sunspot maximum. And at that time, sunspots disturbed the Earth's upper atmosphere and stopped the reflection of long-range radio waves. By the time the ship arrived to China on my first trip, I began to consider that the 11.49-year sunspot cycle might be connected to the 12-year Chinese astrological cycle. As the ship's radio officer, I also had the details of the birthdays of the crews, which allowed me to analyze the behavior of the crew in relation to their birthdays and astrological signs. It seemed to me that the magnetic field on the Earth and the magnetic field from the Sun was having a profound effect on our hormones. So I set out to prove just what effect the Sun was having. And this led me onto this incredible journey, which finished up my 40 years later, talking about gravity on Coast to Coast a few months ago.
Now, as I look at the introduction of your book, this is an excellent book, and it's really an extraordinary work. I see that you begin with the 12 great mysteries of physics. So just I hope I'm not jumping ahead by starting at the beginning of the book, but between how does gravity work, how does permanent magnetism work, how does electricity work, and the positive charges being stopped in the middle of atoms, it keeps them from springing apart, and what stops the orbiting negative charges from getting sucked into the positive protons? I presume that all of these things, electricity, magnetism, atomic activity, clearly they're all related.
Absolutely, yes. And in fact, when I was writing the book, the challenge was to try to explain physics in a way that any 12-year-old could understand. And so that's why there were so many illustrations in the book. And I started at the very beginning. In fact, the first question any rational person has to ask is, why don't we understand why objects drop to the ground when we let go of them? It seems curious. We see ourselves as intelligent beings, and we can't understand why objects fall to the ground. I mean, it's quite ludicrous. So it seemed to me that we were looking at the problem in the wrong way, and that this whole area of physics had to be re-examined, because physics has made virtually no progress at all in the last 75 years. It's remarkable, whereas against engineering, for example, and technology, engineering and technology has capitalized upon all previous scientific discoveries. But science itself seems to be in a loop. It's going round and round in circles. And it seemed to me that somewhere a carriage must have derailed. It seems as though the scientific carriage jumped off the rails, and we've not got anywhere for 75 years. So I decided to go back and examine the work of Ernest Rutherford of the 1920s, a physicist in the UK, who was the first to split the atom, and have a look at the work of James Chadwick, the chemist of 1935. And they were the two primary figures who ascertained that the atom was made of positive charges in the middle, which was orbited by negative charges on the outside. And it was Chadwick in 1935 who discovered that there was also another particle which had no charge. He called it the neutron because it was neutral, right, inside the middle of the atom. Now, that's all very well, but if you look at their pictures of the atom, a few things jump out at you straight away, and these are what I call the 12 great mysteries of physics. These are three of them. And the first one is, if the atom is made of positive charges in the middle, then like red billiard balls, if you like, clustered together, why don't they all spring apart if they're all positive? Because positive repels positive.
Right.
The second interesting question, which any 6 or 7 year old should be asking, is if the negative charges orbit the middle of the atom, why don't they get sucked into the middle? Because positive attracts negative. Now, why haven't these problems been addressed? A third question is, why do the electrons orbit in different shells, some close to the nucleus of the atom and others further away?
Now, when you say shells, is that the same as orbits, Maurice?
It is. It's like orbits. It's like a little solar system. Like the planet Mercury is closer to the sun, then we have the planet Venus further out, and further out from the sun we have the planet Earth, so on, all throughout the solar system. And the atom is very similar in that two electrons orbit the sun very, very close to it, and then 8 electrons orbit the sun, so the atom, further away. And we also know from experiments in the 40s and 50s that these shells, these orbits, are offset to each other by 45 degrees, and nobody understands why. In fact, as soon as we start to look into physics, it's all very iffy and conjectural and speculative. And you start scratching your head thinking, what have these guys been doing for 75 years? Because it's not just the atom. You know, clearly we don't understand why objects fall to the ground. We don't understand gravity. But we don't even understand why a magnet sticks to the fridge door. You know, in fact, so little do they know about magnetism that they named it after the word magic, because they see it as a magic net, a magnet. This is unbelievable that the guy in the street doesn't realize how he's had the wool pulled over his eyes for so long. We don't understand what electricity is. If you connect a battery to a wire, an electric current flows, but nobody knows why a magnetic field appears around the wire. Now, this is unbelievable. And then the physicists started to make things up when they couldn't come up with the answers. And they started to ask questions like, why do stars cluster together? Because if you do the calculations, there doesn't appear to be enough gravity. So they started to make up stories. And they said, well, there must be more planets out there that we can't see, dark planets. Let's call them dark matter. And, of course, it's only because their calculations don't work out. If they did their calculations again, they would find that there is no need for dark matter. And they say, why are galaxies spiral-shaped? Why does each galaxy have a double spiral? They haven't got a clue. What drives the sunspot cycle? They don't know. What causes global warming and global cooling? They don't know. Now, these are just 12, there's actually two more. There's actually 14 great mysteries of physics. But two we have to accept. For example, that the charges, positive and negative, attract each other. We have to start somewhere. And we also have to start with a notion of a field, a magnetic field, which these two haven't yet been explained. But I address the 12 great mysteries of physics, and I solve them all in the book in a very, very simple way. All we have to do is change the shape of the electron and the neutron, and we can then understand why the atom doesn't spring apart. Once we understand how the atom doesn't spring apart, we can understand how gravity works.
Go on.
Once we understand how gravity works, we can then go backwards and figure out how magnetism works and how a magnetic field appears around a wire. And again, once we put all these pieces into place, we can understand why we don't need dark matter. We don't need dark energy. There are no questions. It's all very, very simple. But the problem is there is too much of an incentive for physicists who get grants to do work. They get billions and billions of dollars to build more and more sophisticated machines to try to smash the atom into little bits, looking for glue. I mean, their answer to the problem of why don't the positive charges spring apart in the atom. Years ago, in 1935, a guy named Yukawa, a researcher, said, well, they must be glued together. These little red billiard balls must be glued together. Let's look for the glue. And since 1935, they've built these particle accelerators at $5 billion each, smashing the particles apart, trying to look for glue. In fact, they're now looking for 300 types of glue, and none of it exists. And you don't need any of it once you sit down and think about the problem, and all the pieces fall into place.
So it's then, like, we're back to the ether again. That Morley and his partner thought bound the universe together, and it's not there.
It's not there. No, of course not. It's not there. It's not necessary. It's just a vacuum. And of course, the forces of nature are three. There is electricity, magnetism, and electricity and magnetism working together produce gravity. Electricity, magnetism, and gravity are three sides of the same coin. You've got the head, the tail, and the side. And when you have a look at how the electron orbits the atom, you can see how it all works. An electron is not like a little billiard ball. It's actually a coil shaped. It's like a little piece of wire wrapped around a pencil. And as it orbits the atom, it slices through the electric field between the proton and the electron. A magnetic field is induced into the electron, causing it to twist and to spin. And that the spinning electron magnet, I call it an electron magnet because it's not just an electron. Half of the time it's an electrical particle, an electron. Half of the time it's a magnetic particle, a magnet. So I call them electron magnets. And once you get your head around how electron magnets work, it's child's play. And you can see how the universe works, how it's held together. And from that point, you can then get onto Einstein's E equals mc squared, which explains what God is. Now, Einstein never knew that. I mean, Einstein didn't even realize when he figured out his famous equation, E equals mc squared. That's energy equals mass times the speed of light squared. He had no idea that it would lead to a nuclear bomb in his day, in 1910 and 1912, when he came up with relativity. It was only in 1938 that I think it was Otto Frisch who discovered that the energy contained in the atom was far more, and it could be released if under the right conditions of the atom bomb. But what Einstein also didn't realize was that his equation explains what God is. And it's very sad, because I think he was spiritually predisposed. And, he said that God doesn't play dice. And I agree with him there. God doesn't take chances. God doesn't play dice. Everything is organized, and it's so beautiful. It's so beautiful, how it all works and how simple it is and how it all begins and continues and ends and how reincarnation works and why we have to live. And it's just wonderful stuff, as I'm sure you appreciate having looked at the book.
Oh, absolutely. The funny thing about human beings is they can weaponize just about anything. We even weaponized hairspray and would, put a match or a lighter in front of it and attack the mosquitoes.
Of course.
You know, it's just kind of the way it is. We have less than 2 minutes, and I do not want to interrupt you when you are on a roll. But would you, just very quickly, would you agree that everything is, do you agree that everything is made out of the same stuff, that everything is made of stardust?
Oh, absolutely. Embrace that? Absolutely. We're all made out of atoms, and the atoms come from the hydrogen atom, the heavy hydrogen atom on the sun, which is called deuterium, which is slightly different to the hydrogen we have on Earth. There are 120 different types of atom, and this is explained in the book, again, I hope for 12-year-olds, but there are 120 possibilities of what types of materials we have.
All right, then. Let's stop right there, because I don't want to interrupt you. We're going to take our hard break pretty quick, and then we'll come back and talk about, we'll talk about everything, even how great big ships that are parked next to each other. If you leave them alone, eventually they'll be attracted to each other, and they'll be side by side. Maurice Cotterell, Future Science, on Coast to Coast AM. Magnetism, truly the secret to free energy, wouldn't you think? And yet, how much advance has been made in the study of it? It's still a mystery to all of the theoretical physicists. But Maurice Cotterell, our guest tonight, may have a corner on that knowledge, and he's sharing it with us. Please stay with us. This is the one and only Coast to Coast AM. The names Magnesia alba and Magnesia nigra are derived from Magnesia, a prefecture in Thessaly, Greece. Apparently, manganese and magnesium were abundant in oxide and carbonate ores in this region, and they therefore became referred to as stones from Magnesia. This region also contained large amounts of iron oxides, magnetite lodestone, so forth. So the ores were magnetized, and they were thought of as having magical properties. But this also explains why magnesium as well as magnets are derived from magnesia, while magnesium is not magnetic. But I do have a question. And the question is, it's been recently released that surrounding the human brain with a strong magnetic field yields. Now, I'm going to go off the trail and down the hill with you for a minute, Maurice. A strong magnetic field causes the brain to focus very, very intently. All distractions are cleared away, and your brain computer is optimized for a short period of time. And I'm wondering, I didn't know the appropriate place in our interview tonight to drop this in, but do you have any idea that perhaps the depictions of halos around the heads of the enlightened ones from biblical times might have something to do with the application of a strong magnetic field, which, you know, was given to them for the purposes of enlightenment? I mean, is there any correlation there? Because I could certainly draw one pretty easily.
Yes, it's very, very straightforward. It's just involved, so I hesitate to embark upon the explanation. However,
that's eloquent.
On the first one about does magnetism affect the brain, there's no doubt it does. And if you go down to the pyramid of inscriptions at Palenque in Mexico in the Yucatan Peninsula, in 1952, the tomb of Lord Peikal, the priest king leader of the Maya, was discovered after 2 years of excavation inside the pyramid. And there was a plaster cast head of the occupant of the tomb, Lord Peikal, on the floor of the tomb. This is in the book, by the way. And it looks to me like he's got two magnets, one on his forehead and one on the side of his head. And if you take a trajectory of where those magnets are pointing, they seem to come together at the pineal gland. And it seems to me that having decoded the treasures of his tomb, the way I was able to decode it was by taking the archaeological artifact, making a picture of it in a 20th century photocopying machine, taking a transparent copy of the picture, putting the transparent copy onto the original, and maneuvering the two pieces together, we come out with more pictures. That is how the decoding process works. That's what I discovered way back in 1992. However, there is another way. I now understand that there's another way of doing it without 20th century photocopiers, and that's by using the brain. The brain has a left hemisphere and a right hemisphere, and it seems to me that what Lord Peikal was trying to explain was that you can take an image of something, if you like, with your left eye. This is not what happens, but to make it simple by way of explanation, to open your left eye and take an image of something with your left eye and store that in one side of your brain. Close your left eye and now make an image, a mirror image of the first one, and lodge that in the right-hand side of your brain, the other side. Now you can manipulate the two images from the two hemispheres of your brain on top of each other. This is how Lord Peikal decoded or encoded the information into his artifacts. Because I'm primitive and I'm 20th century, I had to use a color photocopier. But it does seem that, and experiments have been done in psychology, that the brain is affected by magnetic fields and that the performance of the brain can be improved and increased by subjecting the pineal gland to magnetic fields. The question of halos is slightly different because you're quite right. These beings that we refer to as halos. They have light coming from the head, and light is electromagnetic energy. It's voltage. And this whole thing about voltage, again, it takes us back to the atom, but it also takes us forwards to the halo and explains how we can get our soul to heaven. You were talking just briefly a moment ago about stardust. Are we from stardust? And indeed, the answer is yes. And the 120 elements come from the stardust, the 120 different materials on Earth, the fundamental materials that cannot be reduced beyond their natural state. There's 120 of those. And there's two types of electromagnetic energy. There is atomic electromagnetic energy, which is generated as the electron orbits the nucleus of the atom. Now, that is what I call spirit. It is electromagnetic energy, but it is spirit. This is what the Red Indians used to refer to as the spirit in the rocks, the spirit in the mountains, the spirit in the clouds, the spirit in the streams, and so on. But there's also something else, which is called the soul. Now, soul is voltage again, but it's in a different form. Now, it's what Einstein's saying is energy equals mass times the speed of light squared. And in the Bible, it says that God, in the beginning, was light. And the Bhagavad Gita, the Hindu Bible, also said that God is light. It says quite explicitly that God is light. In the Bible, it's one step further. It says God said, let there be light, and he created light from his initial manifestation. Now, God is light, therefore God is electromagnetic energy. We now know that with our 20th century understanding, or 21st century now. And therefore we have to come to terms with, well, how did the universe begin? Well, Einstein says that the energy was converted into mass. So some of God must have been converted into mass. And it's very, very simple again. It really is simple to understand. It's interesting, and it's simple to see what God is and what hell is and what heaven is. And it's very, very simple, and I'll explain it. Let's say that in the beginning, it does help to give figures to these numbers to this explanation. Let's say, for example, that God, in the beginning, was 1,000,000 volts of light, electromagnetic energy. Now, the Bible tells us that God is good and God is love. So the only thing better than God must be more God, because that's more good, it's more love. But the Bible also tells us that God cannot grow, because we know that because he said he made man in his own image, and man cannot grow. A man can only grow if he sacrifices his genes, in a sperm. A woman can only grow beyond a certain size if she sacrifices her chromosomes in an ovum, an egg. So God is telling us that he can't grow. It's as though he can do everything else in the universe. He can do all kinds of miracles, but he can't grow because he made man in his own image, and man can't grow. So because more God is more good, God wants to grow. Now, in order to grow, God created the physical universe, and we are a conduit by which God can grow. He gets bigger and bigger, and the universe becomes more loving. And how this happens, as I say, if we give them this mechanism, voltages, we start off with God, for example, with 1,000,000 volts. So God sacrifices a piece of himself. It's the only way to grow, just like we sacrifice the chromosomes. The 200,000, let's say he sacrifices 200,000 volts. That goes to the other side of Einstein's equation. Now, what happens is very interesting now, because if you go back to your days at school, aged about 10 or 11, if you take something from one side of the equation and put it on the other side, the algebraic sign changes. So if it's positive, it becomes negative. If it's negative, it becomes positive. So if God is plus 1,000,000 volts and he sacrifices 200,000, it goes to the other side of the equation and becomes minus 200,000. And then physics tells us that the minus 200,000 volts had a big bang. It exploded and created the physical universe that we see around us, the planets, the rocks, the stars, the trees, living things, and so on. So what we see is if God lives in heaven and he's now gone down, his voltage has gone down to 800,000 volts, he's in heaven, then the 200,000 that went to the other side of the equation, which became negative, must be the opposite of God. So that must be hell. It's got to be. What that means is that everything in the physical universe is hell. So we're all living in hell. So then what happened is, after the Big Bang, when the planets were formed and the stars, we had evolution and time began. And cells became more and more complex. Until at a given point during evolution, mankind generated a sufficient voltage in the womb. In other words, when the sperm entered the egg, the cells began to divide, the nervous system began to be developed, voltages were developed inside the physical body. But these are all minus voltages because they're all in hell. But what happens is when you get, when you get a body with minus, for example, 5 volts, a baby with minus 5 volts driving its brain, making it think, moving its arms and its legs, the minus 5 volts rips off plus 5 volts from God. It has a propensity to tear off a voltage to balance the body's voltage. So the baby's voltage of minus 5 volts when it's born rips off plus 5 volts from God, and that plus 5 volts is like a battery, and the plus 5 volts and the minus 5 volts cancel each other, and we get what we now know is a human being with a body and a soul.
How is this measured, Maurice?
It's not measured. We can see it by the mechanism. If we examine the mechanism, the voltages I'm mentioning are arbitrary. This is just used to explain the mechanism. They could be microvolts. It could be millivolts. They could be digital volts, analog volts. They could be frequencies. They could be binary. They could come in any form. I'm just using the figures now to try to help the explanation on its way. Now, once a baby's born, it's a human being. And the human beings, we actually have 4 bodies, not just a physical body. We have an emotional body, which is the brain. The heart. We have an intellectual body, which is the brain. We have a physical body, which is all of the cells in the body. And we have a spiritual body, which is the soul inside the battery that we dragged off God just before we were born. Now, these 4 bodies... have different rules, and they exist in different worlds. For example, in the physical world, if I have a dollar and you have a dollar and we exchange them, we finish up with a dollar each. So there's no gain. You don't get something for nothing in the physical world. However, in the intellectual world, the rules are different. If I have one idea and you have one idea and we exchange them, then I finish it with 2 ideas and you finish it with 2 ideas. We can double our intellectual wealth at no cost. Now, we can use the same argument, but take it one step further. If I love you, then my soul voltage will go up. And if I hate you, my soul voltage goes down. So if I love everybody and everything in the world, then when I die, my voltage might increase, for example, during my lifetime from 5 volts to 50 volts, so much so that the energy in my brain releases a halo of light around my head. And this is why high voltage souls are depicted in ancient pictures with halos around their heads. Then what happens is when the body dies, when the cells are damaged or sick, the minus voltage from the body can no longer hold on to the positive voltage of God, and the soul is released. And providing the voltage is high enough on the soul, it migrates, it escapes from the Earth's magnetic field and the Earth's gravitational field, and it goes back to God. So God grows by 45 volts. If in the beginning, don't forget, he gave away 5 volts to the baby, but he gets 50 volts back. So God gets bigger, love gets bigger, and the universe expands, and everything is good, and so on. Of course, conversely, if I were to hate you during my lifetime, then my soul voltage would go down. When it leaves my body, it could not leave the Earth's gravitational field or magnetic field, so it would come back not as 5 volts, but maybe as 0.5 volt if I've hated lots of people. And it would look for a collection of biological cells which are beginning to develop on Earth, something which is 0.5 volt. It might be a flower, it might be a worm, it might be a dog. But as those cells divide and multiply, they generate a negative voltage, and they're looking for a positive voltage to balance out the charges. So let's say a flower is beginning to grow. The the minus half a volt from my body would go to the flower, and the flower would become a living thing again with a body and a soul. The soul is only half a volt. And this is why the Maya believed that this life was illusion, because the flower might look like a flower and feel like a flower and smell like a flower, but it's not a flower, it's God in disguise. Every living thing is God in disguise. Everything has a voltage like a battery which has been ripped off God, except rocks and streams, inanimate objects. They have spirit, because they have atomic energy, the electrons going around the atoms, but they don't have the soul. And it's like your computer. If you plug your computer into the socket, the voltage brings your computer alive. If you unplug it, your computer dies. God is electromagnetic energy. God is what drives me. It's what gives me life. Take away my voltage, I die. The voltage makes me move my fingers, my mouth, my eyes. All this voltage is... In the Bhagavad Gita, it says that God is inside us, and the body is a playground for God. God, it animates us. That's why we're called animated creatures. And inanimate creatures or inanimate things, like rocks and so on, they have no soul, but they have spirit. And if we start to look at how magnetism works, and electromagnetism and gravity, it's all very, very simple, because there are three types of atom, basically, on Earth. The simplest of atom is the hydrogen atom. That simply has one negative charge, an electron, orbiting one positive charge in the middle. It's very, very simple. You can't get much simpler than that. The next most complicated atom is helium, and that has two electrons orbiting two protons, but it also has two neutron charges. Now, all of the other atoms are more complex than helium, and that they come into the third category of atom. So those are the three types of atom. Now, how gravity works is very simple. The electron going around the hydrogen atom spins, and as it spins, it radiates electromagnetic waves. So we get a corkscrew wave, electromagnetic wave, coming off every single hydrogen atom. Now, the universe, 93% of our universe is made of hydrogen atoms, which is most of it. So clearly, all of the hydrogen atoms are pointing in different directions, and there's an awful lot of them. So all of these hydrogen atoms in water, for example, that's made of hydrogen and oxygen, H2O, two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom, all of the hydrogen atoms in water are sending out corkscrew-style radio waves, electromagnetic waves. And those corkscrew-style waves collide with neighboring atoms, the more complex ones. It could be magnesium, it could be calcium, it could be boron, it could be any of the other 120 elements. Now, none of the other elements spin like hydrogen does, and that's because they have more than one electron. They tumble like tumbleweed in all directions because they have so many electrons moving about in different directions. They don't spin coherently like hydrogen. So under normal conditions, normal complicated atoms don't spin, they tumble. But when a hydrogen atom comes close to a neighboring atom, it causes that atom to spin like a water wheel. And as soon as the neighboring atom, be it calcium, magnesium, or whatever, begins to spin in the same direction as the hydrogen atom, then all of the electrons in that atom start to give off corkscrew energy. And that energy bombards other neighboring atoms in a straight line. So everything bombards everything else, and that's why everything attracts everything else. And because it's corkscrew in nature, it's like an Archimedes screw, a pump. If you put a screw thread into the water and turn it, water will move up the screw thread if it's inside a tube.
That's right. That's right. This is excellent. This is very, very interesting. Our guest tonight, Maurice Cotterell, and we will come back and discuss all things that may even turn into... well, what the martial artists call key. Maybe. We'll be back on Coast to Coast AM.